Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. State lawmakers are days away from another budget deadline. This one imposed 2 weeks ago when the GOP-controlled Ohio General Assembly failed to pass a budget by the usual June 30 deadline. This is our weekly reporters roundtable. Kathy Kandisky covers public affairs for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome.
Good morning.
Joe Ingles reports for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome.
Great to be here.
And Jesse Bulmert covers state government for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The deadline is Wednesday. The new deadline is Wednesday. What is the likelihood that they'll extend it again at this point? Jesse?
Looking into my crystal ball and trying to determine.
Didn't they give you a quick call this morning and update you on
it? You know, I did make some calls this morning just so I didn't sound not too bright on this show. But yeah, I mean, I think people in both the House and the Senate would like this to be done by July 17th, in part because, you know, this is supposed to be their summer break. And then also because it's not a great look that both chambers are controlled by Republicans and the governor is a Republican and we can't get this through the legislature when there's really plenty of money to play around with in the budget. And there aren't truly controversial ideas. It's not like we're freezing Medicaid, something that would really upset the Democrats or anything like that. So I think there's a great desire to get this done and not continue to do extensions. But I felt reasonably confident they were going to get it done by June 30th. So,
okay. Yeah, exactly. For all those reasons.
For all of those reasons. So. And so, I mean, it's possible that they'll go past the deadline. I think they are working very hard not to do that.
Huh. Does 2 weeks make a bunch of a difference, Joe Ingles?
I don't know. You know, if they do go past the deadline, I think they're going to, if they do, I think they're going to make sure that they're setting in place, some kind of system so that they can really hammer out some things. Because, I mean, honestly, for the last couple of weeks at the State House, and granted, we've had a holiday in there, but, you know, they really haven't been in there. There's a small group of them, but there really hasn't been the legislative pressure. We haven't seen it, at least, you know, cooking to get this thing done. And so, you know, I think we'll see more of that if they do have to extend it. I think we'll see more of the lawmakers putting pressure to get this done. It'll be something visible.
We know that Senate President Larry Abhoff and House Speaker Larry Householder met with the governor last week. Mm-hmm. Does anybody know what they talked about or have they resolved anything?
I think they resolved a lot of the differences in the budget, but what remains seems to be the tax cuts. For small businesses, what size those are, and Medicaid issues, primarily, as Jesse or somebody said, mm-hmm. dealing with PBMs.
Pharmacy benefit managers, which is your wheelhouse.
Kind of.
Why is there conflict over that issue?
Well, because they have two different proposals on how to rein them in. The House would like to have a single PBM contract, have one PBM handle everything. The Senate would rather give the administration the authority to do what they think is best and not have what they see as a monopoly. It seems like not a big deal, but what may be the bigger deal here is a bill that they're not even discussing, at least in context of the budget, is House Bill 6, the energy bill. It seems that that's kind of hanging in the wings and that the Speaker would like some deal on that. And maybe that's contingent on the budget negotiations. It's sure looking that way. When you look at the way the budget passed the Senate unanimously, overwhelmingly in the House with a lot of Democrat support, it's just beyond reason that they're having this much trouble compromise. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That was Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Jesse Bulmert of the Cincinnati Inquirer and Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Yeah, just to kind of hash out some of the tax changes that Kathy alluded to, essentially there is an income tax cut in both the House and the Senate version. The Senate is 8%. The House is 6.6%. So really, that's not a massive difference, especially for someone who makes about $50,000. It comes out to about, you know, $5 or $6. And so what really has been the sticking point has been this income tax break for people who treat business income as personal income, so LLCs, sole proprietorships, basically those S-corps. And right now, you get a tax break on the first $250,000 of that.
Which means you do not pay taxes.
You do not pay taxes on the first $250,000. Yeah. And then anything above that, it's at a lower rate, 3% instead of like 5 or something a little bit higher.
And the House wants to lower that threshold to $100,000.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then the Senate would like to keep it at 250,000, but get rid of that preferential lower rate for anything above that. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously a much less dramatic change than what the House wants.
And the House says, well, Larry Householder says the bottom line is they're not generating the jobs that the creators of this tax break envisioned when they did it. And so he thinks you cut it back then.
Well, we knew that they weren't going to generate the jobs.
Well, we
before.
Did, but that's what they I were mean, saying. You know, and in fact, they haven't.
Yeah, they haven't. I mean, but there was definitely evidence before they ever started this that they weren't going to.
But Larry Abhoff, that's not his interest or what?
Oh, no, that is his interest. I mean, he's saying, you know, why are we giving a tax break, this big, huge tax break to these people?
Well, that's Larry Householder, but the other Larry Abhoff.
Larry Abhoff probably doesn't want the optics of raising taxes. I mean, you know, that's a bad thing when you go to campaign. Hmm. And, a lot of these people who are taking advantage of the tax break say that it allows them to stay in Ohio because, you know, it's a big deal to not have to pay taxes.
Yeah,
that
it would be a really big deal to me.
Yeah. And they get, you know, they get to invest in it. Maybe they're not hiring someone, but maybe they're investing in equipment or technology or something else with their business that, you know, so they might not be creating jobs, but they're creating some other kind of benefit they see to Ohio.
Yeah, the Senate really sees this as a way to help those small business owners. And I think the House's response would be, well, those are the people under $100,000 and we'd still be helping those individuals who we're cutting out are those $100,000 to $250,000 individuals who may have reorganized their company to take advantage of this tax break or, you know, maybe just got to reap the benefits of it regardless.
But under normal budget times, this kind of a disagreement, you would just kind of split the baby and come to some middle ground. And that's what's so interesting about this negotiation is it's not happening that way. There is no middle ground, at least not yet. It seems
2 days away from the next deadline.
2 days away from the next deadline. Exactly. I would say if they don't have an agreement by the end of the day, it's going to be really hard to get something in place by Wednesday.
Yeah. By the way, it costs the state of Ohio about $1.2 billion a year to have this tax break in place. But there are not a lot of economic pressures to do that either. There's no hole that they have to fill. There's no – everything's – pretty sweet right now.
Yeah, that number came up a lot more the last budget we were trying to work on when the Kasich administration was saying, hey, we really need to, you know, put the buckle on and like tighten our belts here. And so Democrats especially pointed to this as one place where we could really be saving the state some money and collecting more in taxes. And so I think if you ask most Democrats, they would like to get rid of this thing entirely. Mm-hmm. And so on the House side, at least, they say this as a step in that direction.
Which may be part of the pressure that the speaker's feeling because he relied on Democratic vote. He didn't rely, but he got a lot of Democratic votes. And as you might recall, there was a concern about a Medicaid provision, the Healthy Ohio program that would have required Medicaid people to pay premiums. And the House Democrats pushed back on that and Householder has stripped it from the budget. So he's under some pressure from Democrats on his side, unlike in the Senate.
Yeah. Although in the Senate, the Democrats all voted for their version of the bill.
Yeah, what's been fascinating is, at least in my limited time covering the legislature, it's been very much a Republican versus Democratic battle on the budget. You see them going back and forth on things like abortion or Medicare or Medicaid expansion. But now it's been more of a chamber versus chamber fight.
Right. Mm-hmm. Where does the governor where does he sit in all of this?
He likes it all. Everything's good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, basically, he says that's
he's
what he says.
He's a fence sitter or he doesn't like to get out
front? He doesn't want to get in the middle of this. Okay. And he
not
said,
publicly.
You know, they both have good ideas in their budget. And, you know, he's not really taking sides.
I think he wants the deal done.
Yeah.
I think he wanted it done yesterday. So I think that's Mike DeWine's overwhelming position right now. And so you saw him kind of float a trial balloon of, hey, let's take this tax break discussion out of the budget and deal with it in a separate bill.
How in the world would you ever do that? There's so much money at stake.
I don't think it went very far.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It seems to hinge, those tax breaks seem to hinge on how much money, you know, will dictate how much money is available for everything else they've got in the budget. So it's kind of an important component.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you made the link Kathy Kandiski to the nuclear power bailout bill.
Right.
So Larry Householder wants that to pass.
He wants that to pass, and I've heard reports that he's bringing that up as kind of leverage in the budget negotiations.
That would explain a lot. Do we know what the other parties think about that?
Well, right now, the House Bill 6, this energy overhaul, which would give subsidies to the two nuclear plants up in northern Ohio, and also there's some kind of guaranteed subsidy money for some coal plants, one in Ohio and one in Indiana, and changes to all other green energy policies. Mm-hmm. So that is sitting in the Senate. They actually are having a hearing on the bill later today, Monday. And so we'll see what kind of changes are expected there. First Energy Solutions, which runs these two nuclear plants up in northern Ohio, said that their deadline was June 30th and we definitely need the money by then. And then they said, well, you know, July 17th would be a perfectly adequate time to get our money as well.
It's a human construct.
Exactly. So there is some pressure, I suppose, to get this energy deal done. But perhaps because we've had so many missed deadlines on this already, there's a little less pressure than the budget.
Well, don't you think it's ironic just the fact that the Senate scheduled a committee hearing today in the middle
that
of all this?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's pretty telling. I don't think you have to be real good at reading tea leaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's true.
That's right. Some other points of conflict revolve around transparency in healthcare pricing. And as you mentioned, pharmacy benefit managers.
Yeah, say it again. You know.
I can't say that again. I will never ever say that. Yeah. The pharmacy benefit managers, tell me again, what's going on with that?
Well, we've been reporting on this for like a year and a half
right now.
Basically, what's happening is the pharmacy benefit managers set the prices of drugs, and they're charging the state Medicaid program more than they are reimbursing pharmacists for the drugs. So there's this millions of dollars that they're keeping for themselves. Some people think that's a bad policy, that that's costing the state money, and they want to see the pharmacy benefit managers reined in.
And it's also hurting independent pharmacies.
It's hurting independent pharmacies. The Senate budget proposal would include, I think, about $30 million to try and help independent pharmacists stay in business. Dozens have closed.
But there's an idea of subsidizing and keeping businesses in business, and then there's another idea of just changing the policy.
Well, that's the rub. I mean, a lot of people, I know the Pharmacy Association comes out on, let's fix the policy. Let's not have PBM set drug prices anymore. That would fix the policy, but neither proposal, the House or the Senate, goes that far.
Do we know why?
Mike DeWine has asked the Department of Medicaid to rebid the Medicaid contracts with the managed care companies who hire the PBMs. And I think some people want to see it handled that way through the contracts.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That was Kathy Kandiski of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. We'll return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable with Kathy Kandiski of the Columbus Dispatch, Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer, and Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Attorney General Dave Yost has ordered a review of the state's facial recognition system. That's a database, really, that's kept of people's driver's license photos. What spurred the review, Joe Engels?
Well, the situation is that there was a court case that came up, and basically out of that, we saw where a lot of information was being sought by the federal government. And the federal government, for purposes of immigration, was trying to get some information from states, from their driver's license bureaus that they could use for facial recognition purposes. And so the state was asked to give this information. The state has a database, a facial recognition database. The thing with our database is it was developed by bipartisan panels. The rules for this database was developed for by some bipartisan panels that looked at all the different aspects of what goes on with that. And it's available to law enforcement and law enforcement only for specific purposes that were identified in that those panels. Now, what the governor and what Dave Yost is saying is that was never intended to be used by any law enforcement in a way like, you know, like it's being used
for immigration and customs.
So anyway, the question is, you know, are they taking information from Ohio? And, you know, they're insisting that that's not happening. But, you know, we don't really know. But, you know, they're saying, well, that's not how it can be used. So so that's where it stands right now.
The review is to ensure that sufficient controls are in place. What do we know about current controls?
Well, like Joe said, there were some rules that were put in place by these panels, but the panels were actually created after this system was launched, kind of without having those rules in place. And initially, Ohio had somewhere north of 25,000 people had access to this system, local police departments, courts, etc. And my colleague Chrissy Thompson and I at the time talked to other states, and Ohio had one of the most permissive systems in the nation at that point. No one else had that many people with access to this information. So that was a concern. Then they kind of launched these panels to try to cut it down. They had reduced the number of people who had access to something closer to like 5,000 individuals a year later. So I think there's just some concern about who had access to it. A lot of the frustration with now the knowledge that the FBI might have was there was no approval from either Congress or state legislatures for this to happen. And so really just kind of happened without a lot of people knowing about it.
Right. I mean, Cincinnati Inquirer, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys revealed that it even existed in the first place, right?
Yes,
Attorney General's office just established this.
I think they set it up without really realizing the perhaps privacy repercussions of it. I think they didn't really think of
because this is a database not of criminals or not of anyone. Right, this is a database of everybody who's got a driver's license.
And it's
right.
part of this.
No one broke a law necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's part of this OLEG. So it's a system of a lot of different databases that police can go into and scan. Like if you were, you know, stopped for something, or if you're you know, background checks or so forth. So I think maybe just at the time they didn't think about the privacy repercussions, but it became immediately clear after our reporting and after these panels started sitting down that there needed to be some guardrails in place because these are just, you know, regular citizens driving down the streets.
Mm. Yeah.
People are concerned about their privacy. I mean, they should have anticipated this. It kind of reminds me a little bit about how you hear these stories about criminals being caught through Ancestry.com DNA tests. It's kind of the same thing. Who has access to that stuff? And not to protect the criminals, but you should know where your information might be going before you give it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Seems like a no-brainer.
And the federal government's interest in state facial recognition, there's one thing to have a database of photos. That's one thing. Facial recognition is different. This is an algorithm that's been established, and it's not necessarily that effective either, is it?
Well, and that's one of the problems is, and they've pointed this out, that both the Attorney General and the governor have pointed out that someone who's identified from facial recognition may not be guilty of anything. They may not be, you know, the way that this works, they may not be the person that they're actually looking for, you know. So that's a concern, is that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, if Ann Fisher comes up in facial recognition and they're looking for someone else that looks like you or so, you know, and it gets misidentified.
I do have a couple of doppelgangers up there, I understood, yeah.
But that means, you know, that maybe you're not the person they're looking for. So they can't put a lot of stock into it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got, you know, once you're kind of, you know, we all know once you're kind of identified, it's a very uncomfortable position because you're almost like on the defense then trying to. So that's the fear. And you know, when you're using it for immigration purposes, it can and in Ohio, you don't need to be a legal citizen to get a driver's license. So there are people in that driver's license bureau system who may be illegal or may not have papers or whatever.
Yeah, so it's interesting. They're doing this review. I think Dave Yost coming into the system, obviously replacing Governor Mike DeWine, then former Attorney General, is trying to get a handle on how many people are even using this system and how many searches were done for the FBI.
Can they claw back the data? Or is once it's out there? Or
I don't know.
Do we know?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, stand by on that issue. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Jesse, you wrote about the connection between L Brand's CEO, Les Wexner, and Jeffrey Epstein, who was arrested last week in New York on sex trafficking charges. This is a huge story. It's all over the place. What's known about the link between Wexner and Epstein? And, you know,
yeah,
these
I
are
think
two
this
rich
is
the
connection that both local media and national media are really looking into right now. And I know the Dispatch did some items as well. Mm-hmm. But obviously, Les Wexner is one of Ohio. He is Ohio's richest man, as by all accounts. And he was a major donor to Republican candidates for quite some time. He recently said that he, you know, was going to be an independent after a chat with former President Obama. He obviously has donated quite a bit to Ohio State and other organizations around Columbus. You'll see his name everywhere.
Right.
So really an important citizen of the state. And for the longest time, he was one of the most prominent and well-known clients of Mr. Epstein as far as his financial services were involved. But really went beyond that. Wexner purchased a Manhattan townhome for Epstein and furnished it. That is one of the homes that was raided by federal investigators when they were looking into allegations that he had sexually abused or assaulted or, you know, inappropriately touched these young girls and
minors.
Yeah. Certainly. So that was one location. They had worked together on some of the rebuilding of New Albany. There was an anecdote even where Mr. Epstein had commissioned a rather pricey painting of Mr. Wexner's wife and children that ended up in a litigation because the painting wasn't the way they liked it. They didn't like the expressions. So really there's been connections to Mr. Epstein kind of throughout.
Mm-hmm. But still, they're not connected anymore.
Reportedly they severed ties, but the exchange of money and assets, including a New York mansion and a house in New Albany, are all very suspect. I mean, it just makes you want to know what's the rest of the story.
Why? Yeah. Why isn't somebody by me?
yeah.
No, I mean, seriously. I mean,
we may not want somebody like Epstein. Right?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. So the Wexner said that they cut ties with Mr. Epstein about a decade ago, around the time when Epstein was facing charges in Florida, which have now come under scrutiny because he got a bit of a deal. But still around that time, Epstein had donated money to one of the Wexner's charities.
It was their first foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And really, you know, financed the whole thing. So that could be a ploy to get back into his good graces. It could be evidence of further connection. But obviously, the Wexners say that they had cut ties. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
It just raises questions about what was the money intended for. Was it some kind of payoff or payback or... or, you know, what? I mean, they're not coming out and saying anything about it, but those are the kind of questions that this kind of stuff raises.
One of the victims claims that she was assaulted in the Wexner's Ohio mansion, I believe in New Albany.
Yeah, it was part of a lawsuit. So not one of the victims who was named or alleged victims that was named in the charges that were recently brought right. against Epstein, but was part of a lawsuit that was filed by another individual and filed an affidavit alleging that she was assaulted by Epstein and another woman who was like his partner at the Wexner's home in New Albany in the summer of 1996. She said that she reported it. I spoke with Franklin County Sheriff's Office and said that they received no report at the time and occasionally were providing security for the Wexner's house, so thought that they would have been apprised of that. So that's and speaking with someone close to the Wexner's said that, that the Wexner's were unaware of this particular incident if it occurred. So that's where that stands. But obviously that's another troubling connection if true.
For people out there who might say, so what? So the Wexner's were connected with them financially and whatnot. What? Why does that immediately draw scrutiny? Kathy Kandisky?
I think it draws scrutiny because people want to know, even if the Wexner's weren't involved, did they know anything? You know, in situations like this, a lot of the problem is nobody said anything. Nobody reported anything. So the question that I would have is, did they know anything? What did they know? What did they know? And were they obligated in any way to report anything? And did they fail to do that? That would be the key question to me.
Well, we'll keep an eyes peeled on that issue as well. Everything is ongoing these days. I can't seem to get my page turned. State Fairgrounds. Interesting. I mean, we're getting, I think the State Fair opens next week or this week, or next week.
Next week.
Yeah, next week.
Franklin County,
you know,
this week.
For a lot of people, the burning issue is Mike DeWine going to resume the tradition of sleeping in the barns with whatever?
I think it was reported that if Fran DeWine was there, then he would be there. So we'll have to question Fran DeWine the next time we see her.
Okay, good to know. But
good reporting.
Governor Mike DeWine also has formed a task force to review the use of state lands surrounding Mapfre Stadium, and the state lands includes the fairground. And what really grabbed me, I think it was in the Dispatch article, was when someone said that everything's up for grabs as far as the topic of conversation, including maybe moving the state fairgrounds.
Yeah, I guess everything is. I don't really know the scope of it, but I understand why they wanted to get it started. It's kind of landlocked there. And if there's a big development adjacent to it, it's going to impact the fair. And if the fair needs to expand someday, that's going to lock them in.
So. Or likewise, if somebody wants to buy the property, it's very mm-hmm. valuable property, increasingly mm-hmm. Valuable every day.
Question Absolutely. Becomes, where do you move? Where would you move something of that scale? So then they have to, like, maybe downsize it somewhat to be able to move it. But, you know, you think about this, the whole thing with, you know, we've got this soccer team that's going to have the big facility that's, you know, we're seeing that coming on.
Up and, over by the Arena District, yeah.
Right. But there's also, that you know, there's been a lot of talk with what happens with that old facility and where do you put, you know, what kind of things do you do to that? We do know that, and this is not anything that it has been said publicly, but we do know that the Browns have been seeking different sites around here in recent years. They looked in Delaware at one point at a training site, possibly moving from
Cleveland Browns, yeah.
Yeah. They were possibly thinking about moving from Berea maybe and looked
their
in Delaware.
Their practice facilities.
Yeah, right.
Their practice facilities, correct. And then they looked out at Ohio Dominican. These were all things that were reported at the time. And so, you know, are they looking at that? That's one possibility. But if you've got these massive sites that for sports venues and for maybe arts and different things, I mean, it does kind of crowd out the surface space for the fairgrounds. The question is, where in Franklin County would you find that kind of massive space?
Is there a real push? I mean, this is not
my area. Does it need to be in Franklin County?
Well, that's
expertise. Yeah. But is there a real push to expand the fair? Is that a real thing, or is that just speculation?
I would imagine that you could. There's one thing about expanding the fair. There's another thing about expanding the grounds.
Right.
And there's a big sports venue going up in Dublin, is there not?
Yes,
That could you know, an ice arena, a big one.
No, you got to remember the fair.
There's a lot of stuff on the fairground property.
The fairgrounds host a lot more than the fair.
Exactly.
You know,
the yes, exactly. Congress and could other venues be doing that?
Right. Right. It's a big operation to move that.
Well,
I would
the Quarter
think.
Horse Congress is in on this. Obviously, they're the biggest tenant off besides the fairground, the fair itself.
Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe the arts events that are hosted at the fairgrounds right now at the Thistlecrest Center, and maybe the some of the athletic things that are hosted there can be moved to some of these other facilities, like you just mentioned.
Spread the
wealth. Yeah, but you know, the fair has always been about agriculture. We don't have a lot of places other than the fairgrounds where you could have those big agriculture events, and it may be very well be that this task force that's looking into it might want to go back to the roots of the fair and focus on that versus, you know, because the fair is, you know, you go to the state fair and everything's there.
I always go to the chickens. I like to see the chickens.
Yeah.
They're hilarious.
They're in your neighborhood now, aren't they?
Going down the street, too.
You got to see the butter cow. And conveniently, there's ice cream in that building. I don't know if you've heard.
By the way, WOSU, we have a kids' day there on opening day on Thursday. So just saying, you know, if you want to pop down.
Are you going to be there?
I will be there. I don't know what I'm talking about yet, but we will have
having fun with the kids.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of kids stuff in the kids section. It'll be fun. We have lots of it looks like everyone's coming to listen to my show, but in reality, what they're doing is lining up to see giant characters. I don't know who will be there. So we will continue our conversation. There is lots more to talk about. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. With us, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau, and Jesse Ballmer, state government reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer. Last week, lawmakers rolled out a proposed school funding plan that would cost the state $1.5 billion a year. The proposal was around $2 billion for this approach. How is it different?
From the current method or
from version one,
it spreads it out over 6 years instead of 4 to try and blunt the cost.
Okay.
And it also provides some additional funding for high poverty, low wealth districts.
Right. Because that was a big complaint, is that the high wealth districts were getting all the extra money.
Right. And they still would. I mean, they're trying to figure out how these districts that have grown a lot in enrollment but face a cap in funding are really hurting. A lot of them have doubled in size, but their funding has stayed the same. So they try and address that, but there's a lot of pushback from people that say, hey, the districts that really need the help are these low wealth, high poverty districts that can't afford to, you know, teach kids that come to school with needs like, you know, hunger, poverty, things that, you know, educational needs that arise from those issues.
But there is also a big segment of the legislation that deals with wraparound services to schools.
That's in there. That's in there. They think that's what's interesting about this proposal is they try to evaluate the cost of a basic education and then add resources to districts that need them for things like wraparound services and such.
Hmm. Well, what are the chances? This is not in the budget bill. They were hoping to start hearings this summer, but now Larry Householder wants to push it off until the fall.
He wants to work with them on it, which, you know, read the tea leaves there. He wants to change some things. So we'll have to see what happens after the speaker gets involved in it.
He would like to tweak the language before it hits the committee hearings.
That's what it sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, here's the other thing that there's the schools that are affected by these caps, these high wealth growth districts, they have threatened lawsuits. Right. If this goes on, because, you know, the the funding formula for Ohio, the Supreme Court has ruled it unconstitutional. It's been unconstitutional for a long time.
Four times.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, this has gone on for a long, long, long time. And so, you know, how do you fix it so that it's fair, you know, and so that it actually works? And that's always been the question. And these districts that are capped, they believe that, you know, the state isn't fixing it, that they're just letting it go, which, you know, they have let it go for mm-hmm. a long time. So there's a point there. And they want to take the, you know, they're thinking about taking the state to court if they don't fix it. So mm-hmm. this is kind of like the opportunity for the state. Now, you know, the wraparound services, that's something that Governor DeWine has been wanting. Mm-hmm. And he's proposed that. And some of those are even going into the budget.
Right. The issue isn't really how to fix it. I think they could come to agreement on how to fix it. I think a lot of people accept that the caps are unfair, that low-wealth districts need more help. The problem always comes down to how to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the issue. That's the issue right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it will be challenging once we do eventually get a two-year budget. You know, if you were to pass something like this in the middle of a biennium, then that becomes a problem for where do you find that money that's already been allotted to other
things.
Well,
they're saying $1.5 billion a year in that small business tax is $1.2 billion a year in lost revenue.
So you're mm-hmm. saying you found the money for them?
But that, I mean, that's how people think it works.
Call Ann.
Yeah, they don't call me when I call them. So.
Yeah, so, but as far as the future of this goes, I do think it is an issue that Larry Householder would like to see fixed. He sees it as a bit of a legacy issue. He comes from Perry County. His right. wife is in the education
which
system.
Which is the origin of the original lawsuit.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think he sees this as something that as speaker he could get done, but he, you know, presumably could be speaker for a few more years. And so I don't know if there's an immediacy to this.
And, you know, if you look at what some other states have done and compare it to Ohio, other states, some of these wraparound services that are being provided have been provided in other states through their different departments. And they work with, you know, the schools and they work with those families that need those services. But they kind of come from a different pot.
Well, for instance, you could use federal welfare dollars right. to pay for certain social mm-hmm. services to low-income kids.
Correct. So then it doesn't come out of your school. You know, then that doesn't figure into your school funding formula. That figures into another formula. So that does kind of give you a little bit more money in your school funding formula to play with. So it's very likely that lawmakers will be looking at some of those options, I would think. I mean, that's low-hanging fruit.
What mm-hmm. I think is interesting is that the school funding proposal, the Cupp-Patterson plan that we're talking about, has 66 co-sponsors in the House already, more than enough to pass.
Yeah.
But, of course, with the speaker wanting to work on it, it's not going to come to the floor.
There are efforts afoot in local, in city councils, I think Dayton and others that want to decriminalize in Cincinnati as well, to decriminalize marijuana in small amounts, right?
Yeah. So
I'm wondering if the state house, if the state lawmakers will jump in and do what they've been want to do lately, and that is take away that local control.
We'll see. It's, I mean, even starting recently, Cincinnati, you won't get in any sort of criminal trouble if you're found with a little bit of marijuana. Basically, they're like reducing people who possess up to 100 grams of marijuana would not face fine or prosecution for it. And I think you've seen this trend in kind of recognizing that. I think there's been an effort recently to go after the drug traffickers without getting people who are addicted to the drugs caught up in that. Now, that's a very hard line to walk, but I think there's this recognition from things like the failed ballot initiative or just the Senate Bill 3 discussions about that we need to be helping people with addiction and, you know, penalizing people who are bringing massive amounts of drugs into the state. So this is one way that Cincinnati is going about this. I have not seen any sort of pushback from the state on this particular proposal, which I think Columbus is considering following suit on. But we'll see. Local control is always a fun topic at the state legislature.
What do you guys think? predictions?
Oh, I don't know. They've had, like you said, a tendency to take the local control away when they don't like it. So
I haven't heard anything on this one.
Porn. Public health crisis. There's a measure.
What are you talking about?
Foot. Pornography. To declare pornography a public health crisis in the state of Ohio. Not a lot of evidence, or if any, to suggest that that is the case. Be that as it may, they're going to probably get this to a vote, won't they?
I don't know.
It's just a declaration.
It's a declaration. So this is resolution.
It's a proposal from State Rep Jenna Powell from Dark County. Essentially, it's a resolution. So it would say that pornography is a public health crisis. You've actually seen this in a number of states across the nation.
Right.
It's becoming a bit of a trend. There's some draft language floating around from a few groups, and the goal is, you know, trying to connect this to sexual assault or human trafficking. When you look at groups like the Polaris Projects, they say pornography can be used if it's against someone's will to be a form of human trafficking, but the same could be said for someone working in like a nail salon or a massage parlor. Not everyone in a massage parlor is being human trafficked, obviously, but that is one place where this type of behavior can occur. So I think that's kind of where people like Powell are latching onto and expressing concerns about. On the other side, you run into some First Amendment concerns as far as what is and is not seen as obscene, which repeatedly has the courts have upheld the right to display nudity and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the state has laws on the books against child pornography,
right.
Or we recently passed legislation against revenge porn, which is essentially, you know, if someone takes a picture of you in the nude and then while you're in a relationship and then distributes it afterward without your permission, there are rules against that too.
Yeah.
The resolution doesn't have any kind of power to compel people one way or the other. So why do lawmakers introduce resolutions? Why do they do it in the first place?
Well, this could be used to set a tone for the state for the future, to set future policy. It could be used as kind of a barometer of where to start and how to go about it. And that's I think that's what kind of – you're hearing a lot of groups who have concerns about that because we all know the definitions can be very different. And a lot of people, especially people who deal with marginalized populations, they're saying, you know, this could be used against people because someone defines their behavior or, you know, something about them as, you know, being porn when it's not. And we did see recently the whole drag queen drama that we had here in the state. People had very different views about what a drag queen is and what a drag queen does. And that's
and whether they should be reading stories to kids in libraries.
Yeah. Right. And so we did see where definitions really do matter. And so when you're talking about a policy, a resolution that could set a tone for policy in the state in the future, the definitions are going to make a big difference. And this is just at the beginning stages. It hasn't gone through the legislative process yet. But as it does, I think we're going to see a lot of people very concerned about how this could be used, what this could be used for. I don't think a lot of people are necessarily opposed to, you know, the spirit of, you know, obviously most people don't like child pornography. And,
but this,
you know,
doesn't say child porn. This says all pornography.
Right. And I think there's a you know, definitely Ohio wants to be a child-friendly state. If you talk to people, they want this to be a family-oriented state. They like that. That's you know, a general thrust. But I also think they like the First Amendment. So we'll see how this works out.
It's going to be a hard issue to come out as a supporter of porn.
Right.
But it's tricky.
But most people don't come out as a supporter of guns. They come out as a supporter of the Second Amendment.
Right.
That's how they usually couch it. So,
and it depends on how you define it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, to the point of resolutions, obviously a lot are introduced each year. Some of them are just to honor people who have made an impact on Ohio. But other of them are to make a political statement. I remember I mean, even a few years ago, folks running for Congress were making resolutions based on immigration policies. So it is a way to kind of broadcast to your supporters or maybe your donors what you are interested in and what you're trying to take a stand on here in the General Assembly.
But they tend to be meaningless, ultimately.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Meaningless until they are given more meaning than they deserve by using them as precedents, that kind of a thing.
That's what the fear is.
Yeah. You know, well, what are you guys working on? I mean, this is supposed to be sleepy days in
Budget mania. It's all about budget right now.
So well, you just...
And don't sleep on the energy bill. I think you're going to see a number of changes. The version that the Senate has is probably not something that would pass the House. So I think there needs to be some alterations there. The big challenge is looking at these renewable energy portfolios. So the requirement that we hit a certain percentage of our energy from,
they want to abolish
from clean
those,
energy. The right? House does. Yeah. The Senate brings them back but limits them. And energy efficiency. So things that make your home or your business more energy efficient, you can get credits and riders for that. So
did the House get rid of them because they realized it didn't matter, it wasn't going to help get the bill passed, and so just chuck them?
I think it was a version of the bill that they were essentially saying, we don't need the Democratic votes to pass this, because Democrats had really been lobbying for even higher standards on renewable energy. They had had kind of their wish list. And I think the speaker realized that he could pass this by, you know, coalescing the Republican votes and some votes from Democrats who are very concerned about the union pressure of eliminating these jobs up in northern Ohio. So I think he saw a different way to get to the vote needed to pass this bill. I think the Senate doesn't see that same path forward. And that's what you're seeing a lot in the legislation that's this complicated. You see the House needing one route to get it passed and the Senate needing a completely different route to get it passed.
What else?
Speaks to the dynamics of the legislature.
Yes, once again, it underscores that Republican versus Republican thing going on over there, which is complicated because...
Another thing I'm looking at, which may be of less interest to your Central Ohio readers and viewers, but I think Butler County is going to have an interesting Republican primary for Bill Coley's seat, which is... He is term limited. We have Rep. Candace Keller in that seat. There's a township trustee and perhaps another person announcing or making a decision today. So I think you'll see really interesting Republican primaries in that seat in Claremont County. There's another one shaping up in Miami County with Niraj Antani and perhaps Jim Butler. So some of these.
And these are firm Republican districts. So the primaries are the focal point in these kinds of gerrymandered districts, as of which there are mostly in Ohio.
Now, if you know, is Coley going to go back to the House? Is he going to run for a House seat?
I think he might be looking at something else, but we'll see.
Ambition in a state lawmaker.
Drama.
We'll figure that. What else? Just sitting around waiting. It should be sleepy days at the State House.
It should be. It should be the time of year where you get to finally clean off your desk and make it look like something. But my desk looks like something blew up. And I think, you know, that's probably par for the course. Of course, it probably looks like that.
Well, we'll be watching for after Jo gets her desk cleaned off, of course. We'll be watching for graduation requirements. There's a proposal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's.
There's differing proposals in the budget, but the Senate has a new proposal that was endorsed by the business community. By a business group that would raise the graduation requirements. That'll be really interesting. Kids starting high school this fall will want to know about it.
Well, that's about it today. That's Kathy Kangadiski, public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Jesse Ballmer, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.